is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Wisconsin and around the U.S. have seen some substantial increases this month. In Wisconsin, COVID hospitalizations are up over 10%, on par with the country as a whole. At the same time, vaccination rates for the latest booster are staying low. Just about 1 in 5 Americans have gotten it. On top of that, it's the season for influenza and RSV, and some people are talking about strep as well. Our next guest is a public health expert here in Wisconsin with a look at the latest news in the multi-virus season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gotten the latest COVID booster? Why? Why not? Have you caught the flu or COVID, or has RSV hit your family so far this year? Join in with your experiences, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempte is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempte, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon, Rob. Always a pleasure to join you.
Now, as I mentioned, we saw COVID hospitalizations go up some in the state. Milwaukee County, hospitalizations jumped, I believe, 50%. Now, these are coming up from low baselines. I don't want to come in with a panicked frame of mind here. Can you talk about what we're seeing in those hospitalization numbers, what we can read from that?
Well, I think last I checked, our average over a week was about 350 patients hospitalized, which is very, very low compared to where we were, for example, early on in the pandemic and during that Omicron surge. But we are seeing some acceleration out there. The good news that I can share is we're seeing less really sick people. About 10% of those hospitalized are in intensive care. But because of widespread use of vaccine, because of previous infection, we're seeing less of a overall effect.
One big question, and I've talked about to you about this over the last few years, Dr. Tempte, is COVID going to be a seasonal kind of virus with flare-ups in the way that, you know, influenza and colds and other things are? It's starting to look like that's the case. We're going to see it go up frequently in the fall. Does that seem to be the case?
Yeah, I'm going to abandon all cautiousness here and say absolutely COVID is going to become our fifth seasonal coronavirus. So this is something that we will see off and on, usually seasonally going forward. And part of that is going to depend on what variants we see coming around. But most of the respiratory viruses really prefer the cooler, drier seasonality that we get here in Wisconsin. So my prediction is really going to be an October through April or May virus.
You said fifth. Now, I think influenza is in the coronavirus family. I believe the common cold is, correct if I'm wrong. Fill out the count for me, please.
Yeah, there are other viruses that people don't usually think of. They have funny names like 229E, HKU1, NL63, and OC43. So those are the four other seasonal coronaviruses that have been in circulation for decades and that we in primary care see every year. But those act more like the common cold viruses, giving us sniffles, maybe a little fever, cough, and so on. And so we're going to see, I think, more of that going on. You mentioned also other viruses, so rhinovirus, also a common cold virus, but there are probably 100 different varieties out there. And then, of course, we have influenza, RSV, parainfluenza, adenovirus, this thing called human metapneumovirus. And what's interesting is we're seeing almost all of these circulating together right now.
And that's the worry, right? People talk about the triple threat of if COVID and influenza and RSV in particular hit a community at the same time, a worry that that could lead to, because of all those factors, more hospitalization, more stress on our health system. How big a concern is that?
Well, I have to go back into the pre-COVID pandemic days, and quite often during December, January, or February, we would get to a point where our hospitals were overrunning with patients. But at this time, or at that time, it was primarily influenza. So I think we're going to still see that type of effect. But on top of that, we might have a raised baseline from coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. We've had a lot more interest in RSV over the last couple of years. And part of that has been driven by the fact that we finally now have some approaches that are effective in preventing it, namely a vaccine for adults, a monoclonal antibody for infants, and a vaccine for pregnant women to provide protection for their infant after he or she is born. And so RSV has gotten a lot more attention over the last 1.5 to 2 years than it has for a lot of time before that.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID and influenza and RSV and other seasonal viruses, some of them on the rise in Wisconsin now. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. If you're wondering about the diseases themselves, the vaccines related to them, efforts to prevent them, how you've made a decision over whether to get which vaccine, when, and how, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Tempty, we've got this latest vaccine, this latest COVID booster, more targeted to some of the more recent strains of the virus in circulation. As I mentioned up front, uptake on this particular booster has not been super widespread. What are you seeing out there?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, only a little over 10% of us have received this updated vaccine for the 2023-2024 year. And that's a little bit discouraging. This is a vaccine that has been highly scrutinized, not only here in Wisconsin, in the United States, but across the world, and has turned out to be a very, very safe vaccine. And it is an effective vaccine, particularly in preventing the most serious outcomes, such as dying, being in an intensive care unit, and getting hospitalized. It also has been shown to be very effective in preventing long COVID. And long COVID is something that we all want to avoid. So there's really good reasons to get the vaccine and very few reasons not to.
I wanted to ask, people might wonder, hey, I got the first vaccine series, maybe one booster. Do I really need this new booster? Is there going to be that much of a difference between those older ones and getting that new one now?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, with vaccines, we never quite know how well they work until we're after a season. So when we try and calculate out the what we call vaccine effectiveness, it really is after the fact that we're able to do this. That being said, the people who do by far the best are people who have been vaccinated and subsequently have come down with COVID after being vaccinated and developed something we call a hybrid immunity. And this provides the best protection. Beyond that, what we can do to keep our immunity as honed and as pumped up as we can requires what I think is going to be an annual vaccine. We're not calling it a booster at this point in time because it really is a different vaccine every year based on what's in circulation. But this is the one thing that people can do to really increase their odds of getting through this well. And even if you do get sick, you're not going to get that sick.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Richland Center. Paul, hi.
Hey, thank you very much. I want to tell people I am fully vaccinated with all the COVID, but I caught COVID the first part of November, and it took 2 weeks and 5 days for me to get a negative test in a home test. So, and my symptoms, I had all the typical symptoms, but they were extremely mild. But I can understand now. I've avoided this for 3 years. And I can understand how this can kill people real quickly because I had a, you know, lung congestion and all that kind of stuff. And but my question to the doctor is, the only shot that I have not had is my RSV shot. I was told that I need to wait 10 days after my second negative test to get the RSV shot. So I just want to find out if that's accurate. I've checked with my local hospital. I checked with my pharmacy. They're kind of telling me the same thing because I will really want to get that. But I really want to stress that even people that are vaccinated can get this thing. But that's not an excuse not to get vaccinated because it will kill you, I am quite sure. So I will hang up and listen to response.
Thanks. Paul, thanks a lot for that question. Let's start with his question. I hadn't heard about this, a waiting period after you've had COVID before getting the RSV shot.
Well, I sit on the adult RSV vaccine work group for the CDC as well as the COVID-19 vaccine work group. And this is something that I have never heard of. So I don't think this is quite true. We normally, with vaccines, say that if you're feeling extremely ill, it's a good time to avoid a vaccine because it may make you even more so. But in terms of any specific time after COVID infection, I don't think there's anything to be concerned about, except the health system might want you to stay away during that period of time that you still might be contagious. I think, Paul, you said that you had maybe 10 days or longer until your test became negative. More than likely, you were contagious for 5 to 7 days after that and still had presence of some of the viral material in your nose that was being picked up by the rapid test. But again, when people are actively sick with COVID, RSV, influenza, I don't care what it is, it's a good time to stay away from medical settings where there are congregations of oftentimes highly vulnerable people.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is with us, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. He's talking to us about COVID, flu, and RSV and vaccines related to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you taking steps to stay safe, keep others safe during respiratory virus season? Have you experienced one of those three or others so far this year? Do you still wear a mask in certain circumstances? Do you have questions about the vaccines? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about respiratory virus season with Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, answering your questions about COVID, RSV, influenza, vaccines. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling with much of a comment as I am a question. I've been trying for months to get a COVID booster. Finally got it 2 days ago. My primary care provider has not been providing it, and now that they've finally started, it's a one-week wait time, or excuse me, they have one clinic per month to give the COVID booster. I had to go to a pharmacy to get it, whereas 2 years ago, you couldn't walk a block without seeing somebody who was given COVID boosters. So I'm wondering why there is so little availability, why it's so restricted this time around.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Tempty, strictly anecdotally, early on in this latest COVID vaccine, I'd been hearing a lot of people having trouble getting it, even at the pharmacies that were supposed to get it. More recently, including myself, a lot more next day appointments available. What are you seeing as far as the logistics of the vaccine?
Well, currently, it appears that there is a very good supply out there from the manufacturers. We have two primary vaccines, one from we normally call the Pfizer vaccine, the other we call the Moderna. But they should be in good supply. Part of it depends on health systems and their decisions as to how much vaccine to order, when to order it, and so on. And I'm sorry, Tom, that you got stuck in a situation where you were not able to get vaccinated at an appropriate time. But I think we find a lot of variation across the state and across the country.
Thanks again for that call, Tom. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm a 91-year-old Caucasian woman. I have had all the COVID shots, and I had a quadrivalent flu shot about 10 days ago. And so I'm curious about if I've had especially this quadrivalent flu shot, why do I have to get the RSV? What is that? How is that protecting me that the quadrivalent is not?
Dr. Tempty.
Yeah, Nancy, that's an excellent question. So the quadrivalent influenza vaccine covers four different types and subtypes of influenza. And the RSV vaccine is for a totally different virus and provides protection against this other virus that is not covered by either the COVID vaccine or the influenza vaccine. And at this point in time, the RSV vaccine is not a vaccine that is what we call routinely recommended, but it's recommended based on individual shared clinical decision-making. This is one that we recommend that people talk to their doctors about and ask the question whether it's right or not for you. The reason for that is there's not sufficient good evidence right now for its ability to protect against the more serious outcomes such as hospitalization. We do know it protects against lower respiratory tract infections, but we're waiting to get a little bit better clarity on how effective it is for preventing those more significant outcomes, especially in older individuals, say over the age of 75, and people with underlying medical conditions.
That's what I wanted to follow up with, Dr. Tempty. Given that this isn't a across-the-board recommendation kind of vaccine, who should be asking that question to their doctor about, hey, do I need RSV vaccine?
Well, by way of personal disclosure, I'm in the age range that could get the RSV. I know a lot about viruses, and I haven't gotten it as of yet. And the reason being is I don't have any underlying heart or lung disease, no metabolic disease, and so on. But I think really the people that will benefit the most from this vaccine are people with underlying chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, asthma, or any other lung disease, people who have known cardiovascular disease, such as a heart attack or a history of congestive heart failure, and a few other chronic conditions. Those are the ones that are likely to benefit most from this vaccine. And for the rest of us, it's going to be more on whether or not it's a good decision for you. I'll give you one other example. If I'm going to be around infants a lot, there could be a good reason for me to be vaccinated to lower the risk that I spread this to an individual who is at high risk with RSV. And that's typically infants, in their first year of life.
Thanks again for that call, Nancy. Hope that helps. Talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty with the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Want to talk a little bit about influenza, Dr. Tempty. One of my pet peeves when we talk about influenza, it's not what we call stomach flu, right? It's a respiratory ailment. What are we seeing in the still kind of early days of flu season so far, as far as strains and how serious they might be?
Well, excellent question. We're starting to see some activity from the studies that my team does down in the Oregon School District, just south of Madison. We had our first positives come up about two and a half weeks ago in school-aged children. So it's out there. We're seeing some hospitalizations across the state. So far this season, I think there have been about 70 hospitalizations for influenza across the entire state of Wisconsin. That's higher than it was back in 2019 into 20, but it's lower than it was a year ago when we had a really aggressive season. So again, throwing caution to the wind, I would suspect that we're going to see influenza increase over the next 3 to 4 weeks and probably peak out at the end of December or early to mid-January and then come back on down. But that's kind of what we're expecting right now.
We got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, I just got a CT scan. I was the only one in the room with a mask on. We can't even mask up to give cancer patients a CT scan. Unreal, Matt says. I spent a lot of time at a hospital last week for a relative. There were very few masks, staff, patients, visitors, and so on. Thoughts on when and where we might still think about wearing masks these days, Dr. Tempty?
Well, I think any time that one is actively sick, so with a respiratory infection, coughing, sneezing, feeling feverish, it's a good idea if you're going to be out amongst other people to put a mask on. I think in medical settings that universally we are using masking whenever there's a patient. Well, we mask patients when they come in if they have a respiratory infection, and the healthcare team is all masked, or even sometimes using what we call respirators when we have people who are sick. On the flip side, I think there's a lot of people in the healthcare profession that spent 3 years in masks, and they're enjoying a little break from that. My suspicion is the season goes on, we'll see more masking. But I'm also concerned, as the caller, that when we're around high-risk individuals, for example, people getting cancer chemotherapy or radiation therapy, that those are situations where we should do a better job of protecting the people who are most vulnerable out there.
Dr. Tempty, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, and thank you so much, and keep safe out there.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us today about the respiratory viruses out there, COVID, flu, and RSV. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two student journalists from UW System Schools tell us what they're seeing on their own campuses after the administration announced budget cuts and layoffs earlier this semester. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student at a UW campus or parent thereof? How do budget cuts affect your educational experience? Are you in a major that's at risk of being phased out? Have you noticed class sizes increasing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. First, a proposed power plant in Superior has been the subject of debate for years. Utilities say the natural gas plant would cut carbon emissions significantly, compared to coal. But to environmentalists, building a new plant that relies on fossil fuels feels like a step backward. Danielle Kading reports on a debate in northern Wisconsin with implications for the region's energy future.
Coal-burning power plants are bad for climate change. That's because burning coal releases a lot of carbon dioxide that contributes to global warming. Renewable energies like wind and solar are much cleaner, and they don't rely on fossil fuels. But the utilities say those energy sources just aren't reliable enough to provide power at all times, and battery technology isn't far along enough to make it through Wisconsin winters. That's why John Carr says power plants that run on natural gas are an important part of the transition to clean energy.
When wind and solar aren't quite enough to meet demand, it's there to ensure that that system is still reliable and affordable.
Carr is vice president for strategic growth at the La Crosse-based Dairyland Power Cooperative. Dairyland is part of a group of utilities in three states that's trying to build a new $700 million energy plant in Superior that would run on natural gas. They've been trying to build the Nemadji Trail Energy Center for 6 years. For many environmentalists, though, any new plant that still relies on fossil fuels isn't part of a clean energy transition. Jadine Sonada is the campaign coordinator for Sierra Club Wisconsin.
We need to be only investing in this clean energy and not simultaneously investing in the gas plant.
That disagreement is part of what has kept the Nemadji Trail project in limbo for so long. Dairyland has asked for a loan from the Federal Rural Utilities Service to pay for half the project's cost. That triggered an environmental analysis of the plant. The proposal has undergone multiple reviews as environmental and indigenous groups have fought it. Now a decision is drawing near. The Rural Utilities Service will decide whether building the plant will have significant environmental effects. One September evening, a small group is buzzing about the facility in a corner room of Superior's public library.
My main concern about that is that it would still generate fossil fuels.
That's Superior resident Kate Haga. The 23-year-old is worried about its effects on climate change. She points out natural gas production releases methane that has more than 80 times the warming power of carbon dioxide.
It's going to just speed up climate change rather than do what it's marketed to be, which is to be this bridge where we're addressing climate change.
Even with methane leaks, the Rural Utilities Service said in its latest review that the plant would cut carbon emissions overall each year by 770,000 tons compared to keeping coal plants online. But environmental groups argue the plant's carbon emissions are at least a million tons higher than the agency projected. And the Environmental Protection Agency says estimates of climate damages from the project don't look right either. Most everyone agrees that closing coal plants is a good thing. The debate is over what takes their place.
The natural gas plants are being built in part because of the rapid ramp down in coal-fired plants.
That's Karen Clay. She's a professor of economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. If a plant isn't built, Clay says it may be more costly to bring in natural gas from elsewhere or maintain older coal plants. Minnesota Power has closed 7 of its 9 coal plants, and Dairyland closed one of its coal plants in southwestern Wisconsin 2 years ago. Utilities say the Superior facility will help Wisconsin meet its goal of providing carbon-free electricity by 2050. But UW-Madison energy expert Greg Nemeth says any new plants would release carbon dioxide beyond that date, or they'd have to shut down early.
We're going to be saddled with a lot of debt, and ratepayers are going to have to pay a lot for all these natural gas plants that we don't use anymore.
Now, some city leaders are withdrawing their support for the plant. They're concerned about its environmental effects as well as more local concerns. It would be built along the banks of the Nemadji River, and it's next to a cemetery with remains of tribal ancestors that were moved there to make way for a development that was never built. Some city council members say they'll oppose local permits for the project. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, a major round of layoffs was announced at UW Oshkosh last month. The news sent shockwaves around the campus, with nearly 250 university faculty and staff positions being affected by layoffs, voluntary retirements, and unfilled vacancies. And it's not just the UW Oshkosh campus. Many schools in the universities of Wisconsin are facing budget cuts following a recent mandate to get rid of structural deficits by 2028. Our next guests have been reporting on these and related issues for their student newspapers. They say student perspectives should be more front and center when university administration makes big decisions that affect their education. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a UW student or campus worker? How have you and your campus been affected by recent budget cuts and layoffs? Do you have concerns about the future of the UW system? If you're a parent of a student or you're looking for a school to go to right now in your part of the state, what do you think about all this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Aubrey Selzmeyer is a sophomore majoring in journalism at UW Oshkosh, an opinion editor at the Advanced Titan, an independent student newspaper. Aubrey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Jack Schindler-Van Hoof is a third-year student at UW River Falls, studying English, creative writing, and journalism. He's president and editor for The Student Voice, a student newspaper that covers the university and surrounding community. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Rob.
Aubrey, let's start with you. You wrote a piece for the Advanced Titan when the layoffs were announced at UW Oshkosh. Can you talk about the kind of reactions you're hearing on campus?
Yeah, so I started with, it's called Minimal Impact on Students, with a question mark, because, I mean, we were told that none of these layoffs are going to impact us, but in the long run, I mean, we're losing mentors, our professors are losing colleagues and friends. It's a whole dampen in morale, which I think come spring, it's going to be even more of a news break, kind of brand new to us, because all of a sudden it's going to set in. It's going to be real. There's going to be empty classrooms. Emails are going to go unanswered. And I think we're going to lose things that we absolutely took for granted and we may not even realize yet.
And
so,
what kind of programs and campus services are most affected by the layoffs, Aubrey?
I know for sure that our study abroad is going to be severely affected. Our testing center, our writing center, they're cutting so many full-time employees from places that didn't have that many to begin with. So although we were promised that we would have, you know, continued study abroad opportunities in the future, they're going to be more reliant on these external programs rather than customized faculty-led programs, which is obviously, you know, super disappointing. We just introduced my freshman year, so last year, a student navigator program, which helps out first-year college students, you know, just is someone for them to reach out to so they can ask questions, they provide resources. So that was just introduced, and we're already cutting that program. So, I mean, it's things like that that are just going to amount to a lot of change, and it's just, it's disappointing.
And Jack, turning to UW-River Falls, I've seen your campus as one that's had a budget deficit. I haven't heard about similar cuts to what we're seeing at Oshkosh, at least not yet. Are there changes being made, or is there a sense that something like that might be looming at UW-River Falls?
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, as you mentioned, we have a bit of a different perspective here at UW-River Falls than at Oshkosh. And we are experiencing a deficit right now, but it's rather small compared to what I've seen. Between $1 and $2 million deficit, I believe, although it's somewhere in between there. So the sentiment here is for the last 8 weeks or so, the third-party consulting firm, Deloitte Consulting, has been here on campus, and which has been met with a lot of concern from staff and faculty. So our perspective is we haven't necessarily seen those budget cuts yet. We haven't seen any layoffs yet, but just the general mood on campus is one of apprehension. I know a lot of faculty, a lot of staff, like staff I know personally, and then just staff in general who are very worried about those upcoming budget cuts. And so we're kind of waiting. We're waiting to see, and it's kind of a bit of an anxious time right now. We're hoping to hear more about what areas, what we'll see budget cuts, because we are going to see budget cuts. It's just up in the air as to what programs may be cut. Hopefully we won't see the amount of layoffs that happened at UW Oshkosh. I know when we heard the news about that, it was kind of, I feel like anyone at any UW system would have been very worried and just worried by that news, kind of fearing that that might happen to their university next. But right now, we're just kind of waiting to see.
And Jack, you and a colleague at the Student Voice interviewed, as I understand it, University of Wisconsin president, formerly UW System, Jay Rothman, when the Board of Regents was visiting your campus earlier this semester. What were some of your takeaways from that meetup?
Yeah, that was Lexi Janzer, the assistant editor for The Voice. And she, one of her questions was about the DEI programs, and because those are recently affected by a $32 million budget cut that was kind of designed by the State Assembly to directly impact those programs. And Rothman, when we interviewed him, or when Lexi interviewed him, kind of expressed that that he and the rest of the system are dedicated to maintaining those DEI and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, which affect students with disabilities, LGBTQ plus students, students of color, you know, underrepresented groups like that. And Rothman expressed the sentiment that the UW system is committed to those individuals and to providing them with a college experience that will benefit them. But even then, it's difficult because of those that $32 million budget cut to the UW system. So we're seeing kind of opposition on both sides from the State Assembly and then UW system officials, and just kind of a lot of tension going tension going on between those two parties right now.
Talking to student journalist Jack Schindler-Van Hoof at UW-River Falls, Aubrey Salzmeier at UW-Oshkosh with us to talk about how budget cuts and layoffs at the Universities of Wisconsin are affecting students on their campuses. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you a student at a UW system school? Have you seen big changes, announced program cuts, layoffs, or maybe those things looming in the near future? Is it changing your experience on campus if you work at one of these schools we're talking about? Love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with student journalist Aubrey Salzmeier from UW Oshkosh and Jack Schindler-Van Hoof from UW River Falls about how budget shortfalls, layoffs, and other changes throughout the university system are affecting students' educational experience. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a student, a parent thereof, an alum, or employee at various UW system campuses, what are you seeing? What are you worried about? Are there changes you'd like to see made? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Ken is with us in Cross Plains. Ken, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, what do you want to bring up?
I'm a Wisconsin resident. I put 5 children through the Wisconsin system and have been studying diversity, equity, inclusion for the last 3-4 years. And I don't understand why our legislature is, taking away $32 million from the system because they're doing something that's really positive.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Aubrey, we heard Jack talk a little bit about this issue a few moments ago. What kind of things are you seeing at UW Oshkosh? Are you seeing changes to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs there, maybe based on what Ken was talking about from the legislature?
I haven't seen those changes stated yet, but it does look like a lot of our programs are going to be merging come spring and so on, which I know me and a lot of my writers at the paper are left wondering what this exactly means and how this high quality of support can continue to be given to students with less staff and double the workload for remaining staff members. I'm glad, that they're doing their best to keep these programs instated, but I also have to wonder how well this can go for anybody. I mean, we were told of the emergence, but no idea what it's going to look like come spring.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. Something I wanted to ask both of you about, in the legislature, and it seems like this is echoed in some cases by system administration. The idea that liberal arts programs should be cut or scaled back. Some schools, including UW-Green Bay, announcing cuts to certain majors, for example, in favor of more job-focused programming, maybe nursing or science and engineering-type fields. Jack, can you talk about that? Is this something you've seen at UW-River Falls or people are talking about or maybe concerned about that kind of change?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned before, UW-River Falls hasn't really seen any budget cuts yet. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of awaiting, like the news might break literally any day now. So when it does, we'll have a lot to write about. But in regard to, those liberal arts studies, we haven't seen anything cut yet. But in terms of like more, more job oriented majors and programs like that, personally, from someone who's in the journalism, comms, with comms as the umbrella, communications as the umbrella for the journalism department here, it's just very strange to me why liberal arts are being undervalued in the way that they are. Like communications, for example, like talk to any business, any company, and I'm sure they'll say that they want their employees to have communication skills to be able to talk with others, to be able to, to be able to represent the company and such like that. And so communications is a course that's very applicable to any job you end up in. It's less so of a one-to-one correlation, like this major will go into this career, but it's universally beneficial for anyone who's going out into the workforce. And I think targeting liberal arts courses will really damage that sort of universal value that many of these courses offer.
And Aubrey, are you seeing this concern over the balance between liberal arts as a whole, particular majors, versus more job-focused majors on your campus at Oshkosh?
Thankfully, we were promised that none of our majors are going to be eliminated, and students are able to rest assured that they will graduate with a degree in that major. But we have already seen paused enrollments for our school's theater major. So, it's it could be unfolding. I really hope not. But, you know, you never know. No idea.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Patty is with us in Manitowoc. Patty, hi.
Yes, yes. I'm a grandma, but we have a whole bunch of family and relatives and grandchildren who have graduated through the UW system. Platteville, Milwaukee, UWGB, Madison, big time Madison, Oshkosh. I am of the opinion, well, you need to get the facts out there. The very people that should be listening to this information either aren't or refuse to. So please, please get these facts out on the airways and byways so that when it comes time to vote, we know who to vote for. And sadly, I have some younger nephews who are maybe switching to another party because they're disgruntled about how the planet is falling under the party. So please get the information out, and then no one can say that they weren't provided information.
Patty, I got thanks a lot for the call. Must have a pretty substantial sweatshirt collection from all those schools. But Jack, we've seen, and I believe in that interview your paper did with President Rothman, talking about advocating for state funding that slipped relative to other states when it comes to public universities. Is that something that you're hearing people talk about a lot?
Well, definitely. Yeah. Here at River Falls in particular, one of the things that's going through the legislature right now is something called, we kind of refer to it just as our reciprocity bill. But essentially, out-of-state students from Minnesota mostly have to pay additional tuition, but that tuition doesn't go to UWRF. It goes to the state of Wisconsin. And one thing that we're trying to do is reallocate that money, which is about $4 million a year, so that it'll benefit UWRF specifically. And that would help with, again, our deficit and running programs and would alleviate, I believe, the need for budget cuts in the future. So that's just one sort of government funding that we're looking into specifically. It's a specific example of that.
And Aubrey, are there things people are focusing on the UW Oshkosh campus when it comes to advocating for more revenue, whether it's from the state or wherever, coming to your campus?
I think that in total, there was a pretty big response, not only at UW Oshkosh from this news, but just across the UW system in general. And I think that response was absolutely heard by our upper administration, so much so that I don't think that they're going to ever withhold, you know, this information last minute or drop, you know, news as great as all of these budget cuts and staff cuts were. So I think there was a shockwave and it was felt, and it's going to change how information is distributed moving forward.
And we'll leave it there. Aubrey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Absolutely.
And Jack, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Aubrey Salzmeier is a sophomore majoring in journalism at UW Oshkosh, an opinion editor at the Advanced Titan, that's an independent student newspaper on that campus, and Jack Schindler Van Hoof is a third-year student at UW River Falls studying English creative writing and journalism. He's the president and editor for the Student Voice, a student newspaper that covers the university and surrounding community. They joined us for a look at how budget cuts and layoffs throughout the university system are changing the student experience and how those issues could affect students' choices about which UW campuses to attend, what to major in, and more. You can keep sharing your thoughts. Email ideas@WPR.org.